You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Great to be with you this Wednesday afternoon, live from our studio in Johannesburg. And we continue with our crash course in Jewish history. Let us know your thoughts or your feedback. Send us an SMS 34519. Email us on at chaifm.com or you could send us a WhatsApp 061-895-1019. Last week we reached the middle of the first millennium, around about the year 500. Last week, if you remember, we discussed the Greeks and the Romans that conquered the land of Israel, the beginnings of Christianity, the writing down of the Mishnah, and the writing down of the Gemara, which were all extremely significant events in the history of the world. It was appropriate we discussed that last week because we had the festival of Shavuot, which was on Saturday night and Sunday, and Sunday night, Monday, and we discussed the writing, the Torah Shebaal Peh, which was of great relevance and significance to the Jewish world because it ensured that our Messiah, our tradition, would remain intact for future generations. So let's continue from that point on, and we see that at this stage in the second half of the first millennium, the Jewish people are primarily in Babel, in Babylonia. After the Romans conquered the land of Israel, at first there were rebellions against the Romans, as we discussed last week, and they ruthlessly crushed any rebellion, and they made it difficult for the Jews to remain in the land of Israel. What happened was that there were different movements in the Christian world. You had the Eastern Orthodox Christians, the Byzantine Christians, which actually controlled the land of Israel around about the year 500 of the Common Era. And the Byzantine Christians, the Eastern Orthodox Christians, were determined to convert everybody to Christianity. And they said that those who would not convert would be killed, will be killed by the sword. The Jews were very stubborn and refused to convert. And therefore, the Byzantine Christians began a systematic destruction of the Jewish people. It was the first intended genocide of the Jewish people. The Roman Catholic Church in the West had their own problems at the time. They were sinking into the Dark Ages. They had pagan tribes that had conquered large parts of the Roman Empire. So although they were also very anti-Semitic, they didn't have much time to focus on the Jews, and they were busy with other things. But the Eastern Church and the Byzantine Christians made a concerted effort to destroy the Jewish people, and they probably would have succeeded if it was not for the rise of Islam. In the year 622, about 70 years after the completion of the Talmud, Muhammad arose in the Arabian Peninsula, which is Saudi Arabia today, and he preached a new religion, which is pretty much based on Judaism. It was much more monotheistic than Christianity. There were no issues of the Trinity, no issues of the question of Mary, and all the other things that made Christianity, in Jewish eyes, semi-pagan. But these problems didn't exist in Islam. Also, Muhammad refused to allow any objects of worship, any images, and he was convinced, Muhammad, that as a result of these adjustments, the Jews would follow this new religion. So it's interesting to note that Islam only came on the scene in the 7th century. The Jewish people have already been through a tremendous amount. We've come out of the land of Egypt. We've entered into our land and inherited the land of Israel. We've had the prophets. We've had the kings. We've built the first Beis HaMikdash and the Shlomo HaMelech, which lasted for 410 years. We were exiled for 70 years, rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash. Second Beis HaMikdash lasted for 120 years. We have the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the writing of the Mishnah, the writing of the Gemara. All of that's already happened, and only then does Islam appear on the scene. So it's quite late. We've already had 2,000 years of Jewish history. And we'll continue after this.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
With the beginning and the rise of Islam, as I mentioned, Muhammad was very optimistic that he would convince the Jews to join his new religion. And he had some various experiences with the Jewish tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. Some were open to what he had to say, but most of them opposed him. And by and large, the Jews did not accept Muhammad's new religion. And so it's interesting, one finds in the Quran different things written about Jews. In the early parts of Muhammad's life, where he was still positive and thought that he would convince the Jews, he wrote very positive things and very complimentary things about the Jews. But as he was turned down by the Jews and eventually was not successful at all in converting the Jews, so he became frustrated and upset with the Jews, and he wrote many terrible things about the Jews and many vicious things about the Jews. So the truth is today, within the Muslim world, one finds moderates who can quote the Quran and quote the early parts of Muhammad's life where he writes positive things and says that we should live in harmony together and tolerate one another. And one also finds quotes which are used by fundamentalists in the Muslim world to say terrible, scathing, vicious things about the Jews. Christianity and Islam are both proselytizing religions, and Islam was successful in proselytizing many individuals, particularly in the Middle East. Islam swept through the Middle East, and the Muslims drove the Christians out of the Middle East. And that was the beginning of a long-running enmity between Islam and Christianity as a result of their trying to control the Middle East. The Muslims threw the Christians out of the Middle East. And we see that 9/11 is really a part of this long struggle. There are, through the interrogators, they interrogate many messengers of bin Laden. And bin Laden sent his al-Qaeda fighters in the front lines messages constantly saying that they should continue their work and the jihad would continue for hundreds of years and we will defeat the crusaders. And we very much see the continuation of that clash in our modern world, both in Israel and across the globe. The Jews came to a settlement with the Muslims early on, and they came to agreement that even if the Jews didn't convert to Islam, if the Jews would live as second-class citizens in the Muslim world, it's called a dhimmi, in which the Jews would not make demands of the Muslim rulers, in which the Jewish buildings, the shuls, would be very humble and understated, and the Jews would keep a low profile, so then the Jews would be tolerated in Muslim society. And although we see there were some times under Muslim rule where the Jews were able to live as equals, we see that it was in North Africa and Spain, we'll hopefully get there soon, but generally speaking, within Muslim society, the Jews were tolerated as long as they accepted the status of dhimmis as being second-class citizens. And interestingly enough, the Jewish existence under Muslim in Muslim countries was far better than it was in Christian countries. Under Muslim rule, there were no crusaders, there were no pogroms, there were no holocausts. Unfortunately, it wasn't the case when Jews were under Christian rule. So there was no such accommodation reached with the Jews and Christian countries. Through the 7th century, the Muslim world expands and it begins to conquer the Christian world completely. The Muslims take over Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, all of North Africa was under Muslim rule. And then they began to move north from the Middle East towards Europe. And the Muslim world conquered Turkey, Greece, the Balkans. And finally, in the year 732, they were at the door of Vienna. And here was one of the pivotal battles in human history, because all of the history of Europe would have been very different if there was a different outcome to this battle. In the year 732, Charles Martel, the French emperor and commander of the Christian forces, defeated the Muslims outside Vienna. That was called the Battle of Tours. And finally, the Muslim tide was receded and Europe remained Christian. If Charles Martel had not been victorious in that battle, so Europe would have become Muslim in the year 732. But we see that slowly but surely that seems to be happening. And the European world seems to be infiltrated and close to be overrun by the Muslim communities inside Europe. And most of Europe is not aware of this tremendous danger that they face, but it's happening very quickly in our times. And I think we're going to, in a decade's time, we'll see a very different Europe to what we see today, a Europe that is dominated by the Muslim world. This had a big effect on the Jewish world, and obviously a tremendous impact with the rise in Islam. The Jews in Babel, which is Iraq today, about 70 to 80% of the Jewish world by the 8th century was living in Babel, in Babylonia. And the world in Babel was controlled by Muslims and not Christians. As late as the 700s, the Jews enjoyed autonomy. The Jews ran their own community. There was an individual called the Resh Galusa, the head of the exile of the Galus. He was in liaison with the government and ran the Jewish community. There were wonderful centers of learning and centers of Jewish communal centers in Babylonia. The Jews thrived both materially and spiritually in those times. We then see that there's a split in Islam, and like most of the world's major religions, there are different denominations. In Christianity today, there are over 600 denominations. The Muslims have 30 denominations. The main division is between the Sunni and Shiite branches of Islam. The Shiites came from Muhammad's son-in-law. His name was Ali. When Muhammad died, there was a battle for succession. He had a son. He had sons-in-law. And one of the sons-in-law, Ali, he wanted to take over, and there was disagreement amongst those potential individuals who would be successors to Muhammad. In Iraq, an imam disappeared, and his followers said that he's coming back. He's about 1,200 years late. But that's the basis of Shiite Islam. They're waiting for the lost imam. And the Shiites also followed a stricter interpretation of the Quran. And the Sunnis had a type of oral law which allowed them to apply the Quran to the modern world. The Shiites are much more literal, and it ends up being a much stricter interpretation. So these two groups of Muslims split with one another. And today in the world, we see most of the world's Muslims are Sunni. According to the Pew Research Project, 88 to 90% of the world's Muslims are Sunni. 10 to 12% are Shiites. The Shiites are found primarily in Iran. The Iranian regime is a Shiite regime, and they have there is a large Shiite community in Iraq and in Pakistan, in India, in Lebanon. Hezbollah, which is a proxy of Iran and is supported by the Iranians, is a terror organization bent on the destruction of Israel. So they are funded and run by the Iranians. And likewise in Syria, there are Shiite communities, and that's why Iran has got involved in the Syrian civil war and has backed and propped up the Assad government, because there are many different groupings in Syria, and all of them have now wanted their own independence, and it's pretty much chaos in Syria. As we know, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. More than 250,000, more than 250,000 people have been killed in civil war in Syria, and still things are very chaotic over there. The Iranians want to establish bases in Syria, overlooking in the southern Syria, overlooking the Golan Heights, as they've done in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and they want to be able to fire their rockets into Israel. The Hezbollah has over 120,000 rockets that are facing Israel, and the Iranians want to have the same kind of setup in Syria in order to be able to attack Israel from. And that's why the Israelis bombed many of the sites, the Iranian sites in Syria a few days ago, because they don't want to allow that to happen. It would be very perilous to Israel and dangerous to Israel if we had the same dangers on the Syrian border as we do on the Lebanese border, with hundreds of thousands of rockets facing Israel. So Israel obviously bombed those military sites of the Iranians to prevent that from happening. And please God, they'll continue to be successful in preventing that from happening. There are also other branches of Islam, but the main ones, as I mentioned, are the Shiites and the Sunnis. And these two factions, these two dominations, are really at loggerheads with one another. There have been many wars between the Shiites and the Sunnis. There was the famous Iran-Iraq war, and hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of this conflict. The Babylonian community continued, but the Jews now faced a new challenge with the emergence of Islam, with the creation of the Christian religion. So there wasn't much of a challenge to Judaism. The challenge was very clear. The Jews rejected Christianity from the beginning. And even those who converted, even if you had occasional Jews who converted to Christianity, it wasn't out of conviction, but rather they did it either to save their lives or for personal gain. Like, for example, the famous conductor, Gustav Mahler. And Mahler was he wanted to be the conductor of Viennese orchestra at the turn of the century. And he was at the beginning of the 20th century. And he was the Viennese orchestra is one of the greatest orchestras in the world. The board of trustees told him that no Jew would be the conductor of the Vienna Philharmonic. So Mahler converted to Christianity. And after he converted, he was then appointed to the position as the director of music, as the conductor. However, the orchestra sabotaged him. They still saw him as a Jew, and therefore they really played for him properly. And they always, you know, didn't play the notes that were written. He only became famous. His reputation grew when he was a guest conductor of the New York Philharmonic, whose orchestra actually played the notes that were written in front of them. So that's an example of a Jew converting out of accommodation, out of his own personal gain. Christianity as an idea really took hold in the Jewish world, but Islam was very different. The advent of Islam brought about many philosophical questions that the Jewish world now had to deal with. As mentioned, Islam is much closer to Judaism than Christianity. And the main difference is that, you know, the mitzvahs that a Jew has to do, which are not in Islam, and also the accepting of Muhammad as a prophet. So the Jews, therefore, they arose within Judaism, the development of Jewish philosophy, and the Christian world was in the Dark Ages. The Christian world was pretty much illiterate. Less than 1% of the Western world could read or write. Only the monks in the monasteries were literate, but the rest of the society was not. Even the great Charlemagne couldn't. It's well known that he couldn't sign his name. They say also King Arthur couldn't sign his name. So Western Europe was pretty much lost, and the vestiges of Greece and Rome and Greek and Roman culture and development had fallen away. The Christian attempt to influence the pagans made Christianity more and more a religion of paganism, of superstition, and the pagan ideas were incorporated into Christianity. So Jewish philosophy now develops in order to deal with and answer many of the questions that arose from Muslim philosophy. How to explain the world, how to explain Jewish belief in view of Greek and Arabic and Muslim philosophy. The Arab world was very advanced. The Muslim world was at the forefront of developing technology and of civilization. And Arabic numbers were developed, Roman numerals were the numbers up to then. Imagine doing advanced mathematics with Roman numerals. It's not so simple. So through Arabic numerals, advanced mathematics emerged, geometry, trigonometry, medicine, anatomy. As mentioned, the Western world was very superstitious at the time. The so-called doctors in the Western world were really murderers. That was a part of Western society until modern times. George Washington had pneumonia, and the doctors tried to treat his pneumonia, and they ended up bleeding him to death. Today you take a few antibiotics and you sort it out. But in those days, the medicine was superstitious. It was very primitive. That was what was going in Western society. And therefore, all the great Jewish doctors came from the Sephardi world, came from the Arab countries, and not from the Ashkenazi countries. We see in the Jewish communities in Bavel, there were two main positions. We have what's called the Resh Galusa, who was the political leader, and he was answerable only to the caliph of Baghdad. And you also had the Goan. The Goan was the head of the yeshiva. There were great yeshivas, mainly in Sur and Pumbedisa, and there were also smaller yeshivas. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the Goan, was it rotated between the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura and the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedisa. And there was always tension between the political leader, the Reish Galusa, and the Goan, who was the religious leader within the Jewish world, within Bavel. In the 700, the political head, the Reish Galusa, died, and he had two sons. So you got the political head of the Jewish people who passes away in the year 700, and he has two sons. He had an older son who was appointed by who was opposed by the Goinim, by the Rosh Yeshivas, and he had a younger brother, and he was the one who the Goinim supported. And obviously for good reason. They had good reason to choose the younger brother over the older brother. The older brother fought against this, and he undermined the Goinim, the religious leaders, who reported to the caliph, he was the one who reported to the caliph, and he was the enforced ruler. And when they called the older brother in, the caliph in Baghdad, they said, "Why are you undermining your rabbis like this?" He said, "They're not my rabbis, and I have a new form of Judaism," and that's how the Karaite movement started. The Karaite movement, the leader was Anan ben David, that's what his name was, and he said that the rabbis, they made up the Mishnah, they made up the Gemara, and they invented all of these parts of Judaism, and only the written Torah is true. So it really sounds like the Tzedokim, the Sadducees, who we saw previously, we've discussed them, that were about 500 years earlier. So it seems to be a similar gripe and a similar approach of the Karaim, of the Karaites. The Sadducees disappeared, and now the Karaim came forth. The word Karaim is from the word Mikra, which is like Kara is a verse. Mikra is the literal text. So the Karaim were the ones who followed the text very closely and very literally. But the problem is when you read the text very literally, it's very difficult to understand, and there could be all sorts of misunderstandings. That's why we have an oral tradition. The oral tradition explains to us, gives us insight, gives us background, gives us direction. The written Torah is just the essence. It's just like the shorthand notes of the lecture, as we discussed last week. And the oral tradition is the lecture itself, is all the details and all the facts and all the depth of the religion. So if one discards the oral tradition, one's left with these shorthand notes that could very easily be misread. And that was the case with the Karaim. There are many examples where they were more stringent than what the oral law demands. For example, the verse, the pasuk says, Lo saviru esh b'chol moshav v'sekhem b'yom Shabbos, that you should not have a fire in your dwellings on Shabbos. So they took that literally. Obviously, we know in the oral tradition it means you can't light a fire on Shabbos. But if there's a fire that was lit from before, you can still use and benefit in some way from that. But they sat totally in the cold and totally in the dark. They wouldn't use that at all. So the Karaim wouldn't use any electricity today because of their very literal understanding of that verse. But the oral tradition obviously tells us differently. Please stay with us. We'll be back after this break.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Our learning in this session together is L'ilu Nishmas Yitzhak ben Herschel. So the emergence of the Karaim, of the Karaites, who followed the literal interpretation, and obviously the whole movement emerged out of the political aspirations of a certain individual, Anan ben David, and he therefore rejected, because the rabbis rejected him, he rejected them, and he started his own religion. And as a result, so for example, as we mentioned, so the way the Karaim, the Karaites, understand the verse that you should not have a fire on Shabbos means you can't get any benefit from fire on Shabbos. They wouldn't use electricity. They wouldn't use a time switch. And that's actually why the Gemara says that we have a custom, a minhag, to always have hot food on Shabbos. So we have cholent. We have a hot dish on both the Friday night meal and the Saturday meal. That's lechoisi Liban Shel Tzedokim. That's to show that we're not like the Tzedokim, like the Karaim, that the way we interpret the Torah based on the oral tradition is that we do have hot food and we do benefit from light and electricity on Shabbos. To the extent that if a person doesn't have a hot meal on Shabbos, they were suspected that maybe they were Tzedokim. But despite all the rabbinic opposition, the Karaites actually grew and they became quite a significant force within the Jewish world. And we have certain places where entire communities became Karaite communities. The Egyptian community, which was one example, when the Rambam came to Egypt in the mid-12th century, in the 1100s, he settled in a place called Frustat, just outside of Cairo. So he writes that the Karaite community had taken over the Egyptian Jewish community. Obviously, the Rambam, with his great personality and his tremendous genius and influence, changed them and brought them back to mainstream authentic Judaism. But we do nonetheless see, but already by the 12th century, the Karaites were quite a powerful force within the Jewish world. Today, there are very few Karaites left. There may be 100 in the entire world. They didn't survive the exile. That split in the Jewish world also forced the rabbis to explain, to have an understanding and a comprehensive explanation for all that we do in Judaism from the Torah Shabbat, which is a very good thing. We forced to elaborate and explain exactly what it is and why it is that we follow certain halachas and we have certain practices. So we see, therefore, by the 10th century, the Jewish world has to deal with the rise of Islam from without and with the Karaites from within. So they were forced to come up with answers. One of the great defenders of the Torah at that time was Reb Sadia Gaon. Reb Sadia Gaon was a very strong person. He fought the Reish Galusa. He asserted himself. He was a very brilliant person. And he did a few things, Reb Sadia Gaon. One of the things he did was he regulated the Jewish calendar. In the early 6th century, the permanent calendar was installed. The calendar is absolutely genius. It's a work of great mathematical and astrological genius and calculations. And the calendar hasn't changed since it was established by Reb Sadia Gaon. The Julian calendar that we see was way out. It was like 11 days out. And that's why the Gregorian calendar began. But the Jewish calendar was very accurate. Reb Sadia Gaon established the original calendar. Also, another thing that Reb Sadia Gaon, which was very significant, was he fought the crime. He fought the Karaites. He broke down their ideas and their popularity. And therefore, as a result of his attempts from the year 900 onwards, the Karaites began to decline. Reb Sadia Gaon wrote the first Jewish book of philosophy in Arabic. It's called Emunos Videos. It's a classic work that is was really the first one of its kind. And it wasn't based on Greek philosophy. In Emunos Videos, he defines God, he defines what Judaism is, explains the mitzvahs. It was a very powerful work at the time. And today, it's not studied so much. It's just studied for scholars, really. But it was a very important contribution to the Jewish world in the 10th century. He did explain many previous ideas. He just put them down, Reb Sadia Gaon. By the 9th century, the Jewish community in Babylonia began to decline. We see that Jews began to travel because Europe began to wake up from the Dark Ages. And the economic situation in Babylonia began to decline. So as with the decline in Babylonia and with the rise in Europe, there was a lot of movement by the 900s by the 10th century. Large numbers of Jews traveled to North Africa. They settled in Morocco. They settled in Fez. People in Morocco there were different groups in Morocco, Algeria. There were the Berbers, there were the Moors. The Berbers were the mountain people. The Moors were the other grouping over there. And both of them were Muslims. And they, the Berbers and the Moors, they crossed over the Straits of Gibraltar and entered into the Iberian Peninsula, which is Spain and Portugal today. And they started already by the mid-7th century, and they kept coming. They conquered the peninsula, and the Jews came with them. There's evidence of Jews in Spain already as early as 690. So the Jews in Spain, Jews ended up being in Spain for over 800 years. The Jews who came with the Muslims to Spain, they came as equals, not as dhimmis. So remember previously we said the understanding of Jews under Muslim rule was as long as you're second-class citizens, you don't make a noise, you behave in a very low, with a very low profile, so we will tolerate you as dhimmis. But when the Jews came to Spain, that was not the case. They didn't come as dhimmis, but they came as equals. The Muslims needed the Jews. The Jews were diplomats. The Jews were linguists. They were financiers. And because they had a Jewish network of relatives all over the Mediterranean basin, they were very useful when it came to trade. The Jews invented many modern things like letters of credit and checks. In the Cairo Geniza, we had checks written in the 1100s by Jews. A Jew would write a check to his cousin, and he said, this man who bears this check, give him 300 dinar. That was already the first credit notes that were emerged in the world. And so the Jews were essential in the commercial development of Spain, and they became prominent and powerful within their inhabitants of Spain. We've got some examples of Jewish prime ministers, and the Jews kept coming. Babylonia, so Jews continued to leave Babylonia, North Africa, and they moved on to Spain. And many from Israel also ended up in Spain. And that was the origin, the beginnings of the Sephardi world. The Sephardi began with the movement into Spain from North Africa, from Israel, from Babylonia. And that began the golden age of the Jews in Spain. For 350 years, the Jews were untouchable. They became wealthy. They had positions of power. They built ornate shuls, magnificent synagogues, and they coexisted with their Muslim brothers in peace and in harmony, and was beneficial to all. There was there actually was a Jewish prime minister in Spain, we hear also, you may have heard of the great legend of the Khazars. There was a tribe in the Caucasus, and they had a king, and the king searched for the truth. And he called on a debate of all the major religions of Judaism, of Islam, and of Christianity. And he felt that the Jewish argument was the one that was the strongest and had the most amount of evidence supporting it. And so he chose to be Jewish. And there's actually a book called Khuzari, which was written by Rabbi Yehuda Alevi about this situation, about what happened over there. And the Khuzars were then a Jewish kingdom for about 250 years in the Caucasian area. And so we have records of a prime minister, the Jewish prime minister of Spain, writing a letter to the Jewish prime minister of the Khazars. And he said, you know, writing from one Jew to another, let's enter into an alliance. Let's see how we could help one another. So we see this was certainly a high point in Jewish history, of the Jews in exile. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
We've discussed the rise of Islam and the Jews that were primarily in Babel and Babylonia. With a decline of the economy in Babel by the year 900, there was a lot of movement. Europe was just coming out of the Dark Ages, and so Jews moved to North Africa, to Morocco. They crossed the Iberian Peninsula together with the Muslims and entered into Spain. And that began the 350 years of the golden age of the Jews in Spain. And that's the beginnings of the Sephardi Jewish world, of the Sephardim. There also, in the early 800s, another group of Jews from Babel were invited by Charlemagne to come to France. They were promised land, they were promised protection, The Jews came to France, they came to Germany, they settled in Worms, in Spires, in Mainz, and all over France. Although there were small numbers, nonetheless, they did come. They did accept those invitations, and they moved from Babel to these areas of Western Europe. And that's the beginning of the Ashkenazim. So we have the emergence after the Jews now leave Babel. A large number of them end up in North Africa and in Spain. And we see small numbers of them arrive in Western Europe, in France and in Germany. So that's the beginning of the Sephardi and the Ashkenazi Jewish worlds. The Sephardi were much larger, and they had a much greater influence, much more numerous, and they established in the year 900 to be, there only were about 5,000 to 10,000 Ashkenazim in the world. So that's those few hundred grew into 13 or 14 million before World War I. The Ashkenazim came from a very small DNA base because they're all really from the same families. They all married relatives, and therefore there's a prevalence of genetic diseases in Ashkenazi Jewry, which we find even till to this day. So now we have the two different aspects of the Jewish world emerging. We have the Sephardi world, and the Sephardi world is very strong, is very powerful. They have equal rights. They're leaders in society. They are very prosperous financially. And we have the Ashkenazi Jewish world, who live at the sufferance of their Christian hosts. And the Ashkenazi, therefore, are very limited in terms of their economic influence and their involvement in the economy. They're mainly focused on Torah and Torah learning, and as a result of hardships living under Christian rule in Western Europe, they are far less free to be involved in the broader community and to contribute to the society that they're in. So that brings us to the beginning of the 11th century and the creation of the Sephardi and Ashkenazi worlds. So next week I look forward to discussing with you very significant events from the beginning of the second millennium. We have the Crusades, we have the leaders of Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jewry, we see Rashi, we see the Rambam in the 11th and 12th centuries. So I look forward to continuing our crash course in Jewish history next week, please God. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.